You're with us for the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Thanks for joining us. We're spending the hour on how to support loved ones who are struggling with drug or alcohol addiction. Governor Evers signed 4 bills this month to put more money into drug treatment, and the bills are from a package called the Hope Agenda, targeting heroin and opioid use. Do you know someone struggling with an addiction? How did you find out? What was your response? Are you working towards sobriety or to be drug-free? What support do you need from family and friends? We're at 800-642-1234, discussing this through the hour. Dr. Julie Denier is an emergency medicine specialist at St. Joseph's Hospital in Milwaukee, which is part of the Ascension Healthcare System. She got a grant to get drug recovery coaches in 3 Milwaukee hospitals, and she joins us from our studios in Milwaukee. Dr. Denier, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Thanks for having me, and thanks for having this conversation this morning.
And Frederick Harris is here, a licensed behavioral health counselor in Madison, specializing in addiction, dual diagnosis, and relationship issues. Frederick, welcome to you.
Thank you so much, and thank you for having me and having this conversation.
Frederick, let's start with you and how you got into this work, especially focused on addiction issues with people. Where did this come from?
In my childhood, I had some family members who struggled with addiction. So through grad school, I decided to make that transition into trying to help those individuals and the families as well.
When you say they struggled with addiction, what was your life like and how did that impact you as you look toward your own family?
It was difficult. It was because I didn't understand what they were going through. How to give that support. And I did see it break our family apart in certain situations. So gaining the knowledge and using that in my practice really helps me from my own life experiences with my family.
You've also worked in the correction system, helping inmates and people working through substance abuse and homelessness and other issues. What has that been like?
It was very rewarding. I enjoyed it a lot. I miss it. It was one phase of my life when I wanted to be a warden. So I worked in corrections for a little bit and did a lot of reunification of families and restorative justice around substance use and family support.
When you look at those reunifications today, you look at the therapy that you're doing today, how do you help people through such a difficult, dark time when they don't know if there is that light at the end? I mean, that they're going to get on the other side of this.
It's more of meeting them where they are and supporting them and giving them hope. That's for the family as well as the person dealing with the addiction. Sometimes you have to remember that it is a disease. And I think we lose sight of that sometimes. And also that if a person could choose not to do this, at times they wouldn't choose this lifestyle.
Dr. Denier, in emergency medicine, you see people in distress at all phases of life, from birth to death and everything in the middle. What have you seen with overdose and addiction in the emergency departments that you work in?
I'm sorry to say that overdose is almost a daily part of our emergency department shifts. Depending on the day, I'll see one or two, or sometimes I've had up to 6 to 9 overdoses that come into the emergency department. I've been working in the emergency department for about 25 years in Milwaukee, Wisconsin. So I've lived through the beginning of the opioid epidemic, which was when we were really pushed to make sure that we were prescribing medications to everybody, making sure their pain was adequately controlled. And that was really pushed with medications like Percocet and OxyContin. So I feel like I was part of the beginning of this problem, and now I'm seeing the repercussions of it literally on an everyday basis.
And when you say the repercussions of it, what is that like in the emergency room, which can be a really stressful and busy place?
Well, the most obvious evidence we see is when somebody comes with an overdose. And that's the most dramatic time when that's oftentimes when somebody's pulled out of a car or oftentimes they're just kind of dumped out of a car in the front of the waiting room because people with them don't want to get into trouble. So they're whisked into the emergency department, not breathing, lifeless. And that's pretty dramatic. We can luckily, we have medication called naloxone that we can administer, and people if we get them in time, can start breathing again, and we can have a discussion about help. There's a lot of other ways that it's causing increased stress in the emergency department. That's because people are coming and they need this medication to help them with their withdrawal symptoms. So they'll come in attempting to gain these medications from me. They want a prescription for Percocet or Vicodin, and they'll do just about anything to try to get it. And I've learned to look at this through new eyes, that these people are have a real disease, and they're trying to get what they think is going to help with that. So that's a daily occurrence also, people coming and trying to get the medications to help with their withdrawal symptoms.
We're talking with Dr. Julie Denier. She's an emergency medicine specialist, and Frederick Harris is here, a behavioral health counselor. You as well, do you know someone who is struggling with an addiction? How did you find out? What was your response, and how are they doing today? What type of boundaries have you set up in your life, and how do you help? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Frederick, what are some of the most commonly abused drugs? What are you seeing out there?
Right now, what I'm seeing in Madison is, amongst teens, is marijuana right now. That's the biggest thing. Alcohol is really huge in Wisconsin. I'm from the Chicago area, so seeing how alcohol is so commonly, is part of the social norms here, so it's really hard for individuals to come to terms that they have an addiction to alcoholism. And then we have the opioid epidemic that's spreading here in Wisconsin. So,
getting back to drinking, why is it difficult, do you think, for people to see that they may have a problem with alcohol?
Because alcoholism is socially acceptable and legal and is a part of everyday life, so they don't see it as a problem. There's a big comparison with individuals who are alcoholics who compare themselves to, like, opiate users and cocaine users as, well, they have an issue because they do this, that, and the third, whereas though I don't, I can go buy mine from a store.
Yeah. Dr. Denier, what are some of the drugs that you're seeing? Obviously, you are seeing those overdose situations. Where are the other drug abuse issues? Where are they coming from? What are you seeing?
We're seeing, as this has become an issue and physicians have gotten smarter about prescribing less opiates, people need to go to the streets to get different opiates. So we're seeing a modern amount of heroin and carfentanil that people are either injecting or snorting. And because obviously those are not FDA-approved drugs, they're not coming out of a pharmaceutical lab, the dose that people are getting varies widely. They could take one dose and get another batch from another person, and it's wildly more effective. So that's why we're seeing so many overdoses. And we'll know when there's a more strong batch of heroin that's in our town, because we'll see just an increase in the number of people with overdose.
We're looking at support systems in place here in Wisconsin for addiction recovery. We have behavioral health counselor Frederick Harris. We have emergency medicine physician Julie Denier. Do you have a close friend or family member seeking help for an addiction? How do you show up for them? What kinds of boundaries do you set up for yourself? And you can be part of this with your story, your questions, 800-642-1234. Email ideas@wpr.org. Back in a moment. There's more conversation about recovery and families right here on the Ideas Network. If you're just joining us, we're talking about support services for families and loved ones struggling with addiction. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Representative John Nygren authored the Hope Agenda with dozens of bills to address the opioid crisis. But he told us back in December, the stigma that families face, it's still there.
There's never been any silver bullet to address this issue. We've tried to make changes as a state, but just to get folks talking and understanding that, you know, the addiction that struck my family can strike theirs just as easily.
How do you stop yourself from enabling a parent, a sibling, a son, or a daughter with a drug addiction? What kind of strategies do you use to keep boundaries in place? Share at 800-642-1234. We have emergency medicine physician Julie Denier and behavioral health counselor Frederick Harris who stay with us. Let's take a call now. Gretchen is with us from Superior. Hi, Gretchen.
Hi.
What is your situation like?
Well, our son became, we didn't know, he went away to college his freshman year of college, after he graduated, and he became alcoholic in college and flunked out and moved back home and continued to become alcoholic. Well, he hid it from us, and it took us about 9 months to discover the severity of the situation. So, and it was pretty tough. He was living with us, and he would get alcohol from older friends, and by the time we discovered what was going on, we have family members who are alcoholic, and it was disrupting our entire lives. And he would come home from work and hide his alcohol in a new spot every single night. And we would usually wake up between midnight and 4 o'clock in the morning, and he would be passed out drunk. And we weren't, sometimes we could find the alcohol and sometimes we couldn't, but we also knew that he was the one that had to make the call for the treatment, and it was really hard. And like I said, none of us were functioning. My husband and I, we work full-time, but we also knew we couldn't make that choice for him. And finally, about 2 weeks after he turned 21, he decided to go into treatment himself.
Gretchen, thank you for sharing that story. Frederick, what would you say there?
I would say first, I'm glad that your son made the decision to go into treatment. And listening to your story, it's really common what you and your family went through. And I think your husband and you did the right thing to wait until your son was ready to make that call for himself, because that meant that he was ready and being there for him when he was.
And sometimes it takes quite a bit of time in order for that to happen, but also to know that there is something going on. There's something happening here.
Yes. And the fact that you and your husband realized that there was something going on earlier on and didn't exacerbate to the point where as though he could have been way down the line before he even made a decision.
Gretchen, may I ask, how is he doing today?
He's actually doing a lot better. He has relapsed twice. He went into treatment last October, and he's living in a sober house right now, actually in St. Paul. We took him down to Hazelden, and it's still a struggle for him every day, but he has found a support system, and it's tough for us as parents because, you know, he's got to find his way with this, but at the same time, we want to support him as much as we possibly can, but we know the fact that he's still only 21, he's going to be struggling with this the rest of his life.
Gretchen, thank you for having the courage to share that. Dr. Denier, support systems, so critical.
Oh, I agree so much. And support system is, we talked a little bit earlier about how opiates affect the stress in the ER. And one of the stresses that I had was really that when I tried to connect with these patients that we'd identified, either if they came in with an overdose or if they were trying to get opiates, I really had a difficult time connecting with them. I don't have lived experience with substance abuse, and it was just difficult to make a connection to help them get to a place where they sought treatment. And that was the big reason why we sought this grant to have recovery coaches, because the recovery coaches are people who come to the ER and support that person and really connect with them in a way that the medical professions often cannot.
And how are these recovery coaches doing? Do you, because you've had them now for a time, you can call up and say, I need a recovery coach, and literally order one for your ER when the circumstances present there. How is it going?
Oh, it is Wonderful. We started this Recover Coach program we partnered with a Recover Coach program called Wiz Hope. And so in October 2019, we started this program. And what happens if we identify somebody who needs help, we put an order in and we call the recovery coaches. I kind of think of them as superheroes. Mm-hmm. And they present to the emergency department at St. Joseph's, St. Francis, or Franklin. And once the call goes out, they come to the ER within an hour. And what they do is introduce themselves to the patient, say, hey, I'm somebody with I'm here to talk to you about your use. Are you willing to talk? And that's what the first question is. Are you willing to talk? It's not forcing anything into anybody. It's somebody who said, hey, I've been through this before. Do you want to talk? And what I really like about when I've talked to them, what they talk about, they don't give any really advice. They're there to hear what's going on, see what's going on in that person's life at that point, and see if they can meet them at that point in their life to see if they can get them some help.
We're talking with Dr. Julie Denier, who received a grant to provide drug recovery coaches for several Milwaukee hospitals. Frederick Harris is here as well. He's worked in corrections, behavioral health counselor in the community, providing substance abuse counseling. Do you have a close friend or family member seeking help for an addiction? How do you show up for them? And how difficult is that connection to what they're going through? We're at 800-642-1234. You can email ideas@wpr.org. Dr. Denier, I want to touch on stigma and shame, which comes up when we talk about addiction. How difficult is it for families to work through the process of feeling like they failed in some way and that they are shameful that there is an addiction in the family?
You have brought up such an important part of opiate and substance abuse. Stigma and shame really stops people from talking about the problem. And that's why I'm so excited that you're doing this today. And I'm so thankful to people like Gretchen who called in, who share their story. Just talking is the first step, and there is so much help out there that if we talk about it and bring it out in the open, we can share ideas about how to help it. If we get rid of stigma and shame, we can really have more honest conversations. People can be honest with healthcare providers. There's a lot of stigma and shame about the fact that people have an opiate addiction. So instead of coming in and having an honest conversation with me about I'm struggling with opiates, I need to get my next fix, they will make up a story about back pain that they need a prescription. If there's less stigma and shame, they can come in and say, just I need some help. So thank you for having this conversation today.
Frederick Harris, when you talk with families, is it difficult for them or a particular family member to confront that addiction head on to say, this is happening? Or do you still find some family members are turning away for it, perhaps in denial?
I see both. And the stigma and shame is a big component to why I see both. The families that tend to turn and don't know how to approach it is because they're in denial themselves and be what that addiction or that person's addiction does to them as the family. So they stop focusing on the individual who has the problem and focus on what they have done to probably promote and have this person this addiction. And the families that approach it head on, they still have some difficulties with understanding why their loved one is doing this. And I like the idea of talking about stigma and shame because that's why the person is continuing to be in the addiction. We remember that shame keeps them using and then that stigma. So the longer we don't talk about it and families ignore it, that's the longer they stay within that addiction.
We have Tony who sent us an email saying, I lost my 33-year-old brother in November to an overdose. The brother was in the ER in Appleton with an overdose. They revived him. Apparently, he insisted on leaving. It's too difficult for me to get all the details at this time. He left the ER, walked to the nearest gas station, overdosed again, and died. And Tony is wondering whether it's there are any policies to keep people in place in the ER. Dr. Denier, can you address that?
That's a great question. And wow, something that happens all the time. When somebody wakes up, I'll describe what happens, and I'm not experienced, but I can just describe it from a medical point of view. When somebody overdoses and they're given naloxone, the naloxone counteracts the opiate in their body, and it makes them breathe again, and it wakes them up. But it does something else. It knocks all that opiate off the pain receptors and throws that patient into fulminant withdrawal. So they feel horrific. Every part of that withdrawal that feels horrible is on them 100 times. So it's a difficult time to have a conversation about, please stay here and have a conversation. They need to go get their next fix. So that's something that happens very often.
Talking with emergency medicine specialist Julie Denier from St. Joseph's Hospital and behavioral health counselor Frederick Harris, who is in private practice with New Beginnings Counseling Center in Fitchburg. You as well, do you have a substance abuse disorder? What does your recovery look like? What prompted you to seek help? Bring your story, 800-642-1234. We'll get back to this after a news update here on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. Thanks for being here. We're talking about how to help loved ones on their journey to recovery from drug and alcohol addiction. The opioid epidemic, it's ripped apart families straight across the country. Opioid overdoses kill hundreds of Wisconsinites every year as we see a nationwide surge in painkiller and heroin abuse. Did you grow up with a parent or sibling who was addicted to drugs? How did your family navigate that situation? How is the person doing today? And what feelings do you harbor about that addiction? Bring your questions, your stories, 800-642-1234. We have Dr. Julie Denier, an emergency medicine specialist at St. Joseph's Hospital in Milwaukee, and Frederick Harris, a behavioral health counselor based in Madison who focuses on addiction and relationship issues. Let's take another call now. Debbie is joining us this morning from Norwalk. Hi, Debbie.
Good morning.
Good morning.
So I'm a retired corrections officer for 16 years in a men's medium. My new husband retired 32 years from a federal prison running the drug and alcohol unit. And my daughter, 2.5 years ago, was released from a federal prison on meth charges for delivery and use. And I've been listening. My opinion is I wanted her locked up. So I called the probation officer and gave her all the information. She disregarded it, and they had to wait until she did cross state lines. And she spent 4 years in a federal prison. She did do the alcohol and drug program. She got a year off her sentence. She's been sober now 4 years, February 1st. And she's doing very well in her recovery. And she's also on the board of a group called Sober Eyes that meets throughout the week and every Sunday night. And she's doing well, but it was a lot of tough love. And I know a lot of parents choose not to believe that their children are using and dealing. I took the tough road and wanted her locked up. The day I found out she was locked up was the best day of my life because I knew she was going to get the help that she needed, and it worked.
Debbie, what is Sober Eyes like, and what type of support is she getting there?
It's a group that meets. It's people with addictions, no matter what it is. And it's ran by a wonderful man who was an EMT and just felt calling. And he got this group together, and they went from 12 to, I believe, sometimes they're up to 40, and they're expanding in other towns. They march in parades. They do activities with youth. They sell T-shirts. They have meetings twice a week. But they're doing very well. We also went. We were invited to a church. And I went with my daughter and three other members, and they told their stories. And then I told my story as a parent and how it affected, you know, my family. And it's a wonderful support group.
Debbie, thank you for sharing your story. Frederick, what do you hear there about what Debbie says, that it was the happiest day of her life when her daughter was incarcerated?
Debbie, as you were speaking, I wanted to first commend you for taking that making that hard decision to get your daughter incarcerated, because we forget sometimes you have to take the tough love approach. And I'm not a parent, but as a parent, I know it could be really hard to make those decisions. And I've seen recovery when parents make those boundaries and take those actions to give tough love. And sometimes being incarcerated is the best result at times. So I'm glad to hear that your daughter is doing well and sober.
Dr. Denier, and it sounds like there were community support systems with the Sober Eyes program that is expanding.
There's so many different supports out there, and I think that's what I really want people to know, that there is hope and there's a lot of support systems. One of the group that I work with is called Wiz Hope, and they've got a great website. If you go to Wiz Hope, WISHOPE.org. They have a map that you can hover over, and it's the whole state of Wisconsin that you can go and see what treatment is available and where you can go to get help. Because everyone's recovery looks different. Debbie had a example of incarceration was needed, but everybody's recovery is going to be a little bit different, and it's got to be right for them. So there's a lot of different treatment options out there. There's medical-assisted treatment. There's psychosocial support. But it's just important to start that conversation. And so I really, really encourage people, if you're dealing with this or if you're a family member dealing with this, go online and find some support and get education and have conversations about what the next step needs to be.
Debbie, thanks. Let's bring in John now in Kenosha. John, hi.
Good morning. How are you guys?
Doing well. What is your story?
Good. Yeah, well, thank you very much for the topic. It's very interesting. You guys do a great job every day. It's kind of hard to summarize it, but, you know, without taking up too much time. But basically, I've been a spinal patient now for 15 years. I had a lumbar fusion done 15 years ago. I was a very healthy, active individual at the time. And after it, you know, I knew I was going to have to go through recovery. I started working out. I went to the gym every day almost for about 3 years until I injured my neck and ended up having a cervical fusion. Mm. I was losing power in my left arm and my biceps, my left bicep, all the way down to my fingers. So the back, you know, the fusion never mitigated the pain completely, but I was able to function more so than I thought. However, following the cervical fusion, I started to develop tremendous pains in my shoulder blades and in my, again, going back to the neck, and on stressful days, my back would begin to ache again. So long story short, I went to see, I had two surgeries done by two very renowned neurosurgeons in Illinois. So I'd kind of given up on them, you know, because the last time I went to see them about my pain, I could literally not walk on my left leg and was walked out the door by the surgeon saying that everything was great. I was doing well. I was crying walking out the door. So, you know, they had gotten their money out of me. They had cut me twice, and there was nothing more they could do for me. So I went to see an orthopedic surgeon. I was in his office. I was in tears and pain, and he asked me the simple question, do you need some pain medication? I had never taken any form of medication. I just had no interest in it, even if I had a headache. But I was on, I ended up going from Norco over the span of a year to OxyContin and Percocet.
Oh,
so I was on a very high... Oh, sorry, go ahead.
No, so it sounds like you were on a high dosage of painkiller and then dealing with addiction. Dr. Denier, I want you to have a moment here to respond to John's situation as he tells it.
It's a typical situation. I do not want to demonize all of narcotics. Percocet, Vicodin have a place in medicine for acute pain. Where we get into trouble with opiates is when we're using for chronic pain. And John, you may know this as as opiates are taken chronically, your body needs more and more, and they don't work as well for pain. So that may be what you're experiencing, John. You take more and more, you get a lot more of the side effects, and you get addicted, but it doesn't really work for the pain as well in the long term. So we're really working on trying to, number one, prescribe less chronic opiates, and number two, really delve into how to treat pain better. Our plan in the medical world is just to stop treating pain. We want to treat it smarter so that people can deal with pain and live their lives in a better way. That can be through injections of steroids. That can be through non-narcotic medications, can be through physical therapy. But it's been a real learning curve for me, because I've had to learn as an older doctor all these new realms of how to try to treat pain without opiates chronically.
John, may I ask how you're doing today?
As your speaker has mentioned, all her points I totally agree with. But my doctor, you know, at the time who started prescribing pain medication, you know, he was in a similar situation where he really wasn't qualified to be allocating heavy, heavy doses of pain medication. And there was one scary morning driving to work where I actually fell asleep and drove up on a footpath on the side of a road. So that was a turning point for me where I ended up going to pain management. They did, as your speaker is saying, they reduced the levels of medication I'm on. But the stigma is there. I do not abuse pain medication. I take it regimentally on a much lower dosage to what I have been on. But they're still trying continuously to wean me off it to a point now where I'm getting very anxious, because without this medication, I can't go to work. I get up at 5 o'clock in the morning and get home at 6-7 o'clock in the evening.
And so it really impacts your whole life as you try to get off the medication. Frederick Harris, what do you tell people in those situations where they know there is an issue and they're trying to address that pain, but mm-hmm. it's really difficult?
I hear what John is saying. I have patients that come to me with the same issues when they know they have physical pain and they need the medications. What I recommend to them, well, first I'll say, John, you're doing a great job by going to a pain management clinic. Instead of going to some doctors, they do overly prescribe at times. That's a given, and they're not qualified to do so. So it's also the therapy component, too, when you're dealing with medications, because at some point, no matter if it's pain management clinics or methadone clinics or anything, your body becomes physically dependent. Then it becomes a more psychological thing that I need these medications to survive or to work. So that's why the component of therapy is very important as well, to work through those and continue to work with your medical doctors about how to minimize that pain without the opiates.
Behavioral health counselor Frederick Harris is here. He started working in the criminal justice system, where he was a therapist to people dealing with substance abuse. Dr. Julie Denier, an emergency medicine specialist at St. Joseph's Hospital in Milwaukee. Still time for you to share what you've learned about helping a family member through addiction. 800-642-1234. Back in a moment on the Ideas Network. It's the morning show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're with us for a conversation about addiction and how to help loved ones through the stages. Ren from Milwaukee called in, couldn't stay with us, but Ren wanted to bring up AA, Alcoholics Anonymous, and how it can help people. Ren had dealt with an alcohol addiction, but is 18 years sober because of this organization. Rick from Holman, who we talked with earlier, also wanted to say that he's 40 years sober of being on drug and alcohol and wants people to know that the systems out there, that they work. Ren and Rick, thank you so much for those comments. Still time for you at 800-642-1234. Frederick Harris is a behavioral health counselor, and Dr. Julie Denier is an emergency medicine specialist. Frederick, what is that first step to take when someone notices the signs of addiction in a family member or a friend? What do you do?
I would recommend that person talking to a professional about how to approach their loved one. One, to reduce any harm that they may get from that person of decreasing if they act out or try to resist any form of treatment, and receiving some education about addiction. And then that way they can approach their loved one with the best intentions and allow them to know they're coming with them with no judgment, just out of love.
Dr. Denier, people enter hospitals for many reasons. They enter ERs for many reasons. How do medical professionals know when someone has an addiction to drugs?
We can figure it out in several ways. The most obvious is when somebody comes in with overdose or requesting detoxification from substances. That's a no-brainer. However, we do have access to the Prescription Drug Monitoring Program, which is a statewide program that all physicians have access to. So if a patient comes in requesting medications, I can get on this and see every opiate or benzodiazepine that's been prescribed to them over the last few years. So I can see if they've gone to different ERs. Also, I can look at somebody's medical record and just see if they're on too many – on chronic opiates or on opiates with benzodiazepines, which really puts them at risk for big problems. Those are the big things. And what I usually do when this happens is, number one, we will call the recovery coach to talk to those people. And number two, if it's a opiate addiction specifically, I will prescribe them naloxone. And that would be one of my advice for people listening. If you have somebody you love who is a substance abuser, specifically with opiates, a naloxone is a really important thing to have in the home or nearby. And that can be gotten without a prescription. And it's a medication that if somebody does overdose, you can open the package and simply squirt it up their nose, and it counteracts the opiates and can make them breathe again. So in addition to what Frederica said was right on, the only medical part I would add to that is just I think it's helpful to have naloxone on hand in a home if you've got somebody who's struggling with specifically opiate addiction.
Let's bring in Pat now in La Crosse. Hi, Pat.
Hi.
What is your story?
My son is in the Twin Cities, and he's newly divorced, and he's struggling with alcohol addiction, and he has new insurance because of the divorce, and he has called a rehabilitation recovery place. He has to do 30 days in order to regain as one of the steps to regain custody of his son. And the rehabilitation place said that they do not accept his insurance. So I'm concerned about that. And his doctor had said this would be a good place for him to be.
So he has the rehabilitation center there and chosen, and yet insurance won't cover. Frederick Harris, what about this?
The place will not accept his insurance.
Yeah.
Pat, this is pretty common with treatment facilities, sometimes not accepting some forms of insurance, especially with the epidemic of addiction. A lot of insurance companies aren't paying for treatment. We're starting to see that a little bit now. What I recommend is if your son can contact his insurance company, and then they can give him some providers that would probably accept his insurance. In the Twin Cities, there's tons of places that do have rehabilitation programs, but he probably just needs to call the insurance company, let them know what he's looking for, and they can let him know what covers.
Yeah, Pat, thank you for the call. Let's bring in Wade now in Madison. Wade, hi.
Hi, thanks for having me on the air.
You're welcome.
So what I wanted to comment on is that if the opioid crisis, in my opinion, is kind of like an acute symptom of an underlying disease, and addiction, of course, as we know, is a disease, but there are all kinds of variations of it, including alcoholism, which is what really kind of destroyed most of my life, within my family, my mother had alcohol addiction, which led to the collapse of her marriage. But she was awarded custody, and my father then kidnapped the children, smuggled us out of the country. But there, my uncle had alcoholism, which he eventually died of. My sister has suffered from addiction all her life. I had struggled with early alcohol and drug abuse, but was able to overcome it. And had a level of pride around that my whole life, that I was able to overcome this and didn't have this problem. And it was only about 12, 13 years ago where I realized, look, I'm part of the problem, because in my pride and arrogance, I can continue to use a mind-altering or mood-altering substance. And it permeates our society from every advertisement, you know, that promises a pill is going to fix every problem. And so our societal immune system is weakened by our attitudes towards these substances. And that allows for such an acute manifestation like the opioid crisis. And that's just what I've been thinking about lately.
Wade, thank you for bringing that to the table. Dr. Denier, he sees and draws a societal issue here.
I agree. Specific with alcohol, it's just so part of the society. If you want to stop drinking alcohol, it's a whole different way of living. These things are interwoven into all the norms. I agree with what he said. Everything, it's the expectation is, if you have a pain, you take a pill. And that's kind of what got us into this problem in the first place. So I think he hit it right on the head. We need to change how we're thinking and be aware as a society that this is a struggle. So really make that part of our daily life decisions to try to avoid those things and make changes that will affect positive things for other people.
Dr. Denier, you've worked in ERs for so many years. Where do you find hope?
One of the places I really find hope right now is with the recovery coaches that come to my ER. The people who that respond to the ER and are the recovery coaches have lived experience. They've been through this. They've been addicted to drugs. They've been in jail. They have been hopeless. And they are so full of hope and are doing good every day. And it's a joy to see them every day. And when I feel hopeless, if I see a patient that I think, oh, I can't help them, I look at these amazing people that come to my ER and help people. And I just think anything is possible if they're doing what they are doing.
Frederick Harris, when you meet with your families, where do you find hope in the future?
I would have to say having my own practice now gives me the most hope with all of my patients and their families, working with them, seeing that they're working together, and being a part of their decision to make these changes in their lives and their loved ones.
Frederick, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And Dr. Denier, thank you for taking the time. We appreciate it.
Thank you for having this conversation.
Dr. Julie Denier is an emergency medicine specialist who joined us from our Milwaukee studios. Frederick Harris is a behavioral health counselor who joined us from Madison. If you or a loved one needs help connecting to services, call the 3-digit number 211 to get started navigating many nonprofit and government resources in your area. Coming up, it's On Point. What's next in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination as Michigan and other key states go to the polls this week? We get the latest in the race for the Democratic presidential nomination. This is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent, and you're listening to the Ideas Network.